online at our secure website, willpledge.org. And thanks.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock here at WILL AM 580. Time to jump to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a live show for you today, a much-awaited show. We hope to have it last week, but fortunately we have it this week. Our guest will be Noam Chomsky, live on the line with us from his home in Massachusetts. It should be a terrific show, a show that will be unforgettable for those of you who have never heard Noam Chomsky before, and worthwhile for everyone else. So please join us for the full hour today with Noam Chomsky. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A hidden application that can track just about everything users do on their cell phones has been found on several models of AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile Android phones. The software, developed by a company called Carrier IQ, can track what keys are pressed, what numbers are dialed, and what websites are visited. Carrier IQ says that just because the software receives information doesn't necessarily mean that carriers use it to gather intelligence about their users. But Free Press Internet campaign director Josh Levy says that Carrier IQ's answers about its product has only led to more questions.
What Carrier IQ software does and doesn't do, and what it does and doesn't do with the software, is a little bit unclear.
Carrier IQ may not want to take responsibility for how its software is being used, but new evidence shows that someone is using it. In response to a Freedom of Information Act request, the FBI has admitted that it uses the software for law enforcement purposes, says journalist Michael Morrissey. The agency wouldn't elaborate further, saying the release of its records could interfere with pending or prospective law enforcement proceedings.
The FBI's response confirms our darkest fears about what could be happening with Carrier IQ and the wireless carriers. Most Americans use their cell phones to talk to their friends and their families and their work colleagues. They're sending emails, they're receiving and sending text messages. When these companies have access to that information and are apparently willing to comply with requests to give it to federal agencies, we then have a major breach in our privacy.
Free Press has called for an investigation by Congress and the Department of Justice. Representative Ed Markey and Senator Al Franken have written to Carrier IQ and demanded answers about its practices. Franken has also written to AT&T, HTC, Samsung, and Sprint to learn which devices contain the software, how long it's been in use, and what data is being collected. And now the Federal Trade Commission is investigating. More than 140 phones have this software, which can't be deactivated unless the operating system is replaced. Virtually no one had heard of it until a 25-year-old researcher from Connecticut named Trevor Eckhart made a video explaining what he had discovered on his phone. Carrier IQ fanned the flames of suspicion when it tried, without success, to remove Eckhart's video from YouTube. Levy says there's a bigger story here about privacy laws in America.
At a very basic level, we need to know that our right to communicate is being protected and that big companies aren't spying on us. It's as simple as that. And if these big companies are spying on us, they need to be held accountable.
A bill that would have allowed marketers and bill collectors to make countless calls to mobile phones has fizzled in Congress. Backlash from public interest groups, lawmakers, and everyday people has helped squash the bill, which would have used up precious cell phone minutes that users pay for. The bill, called the Mobile Informational Call Act of 2011, would have amended earlier legislation that protects cell phones from robocalls, pre-automated computerized phone calls. Delicia Reynolds, legislative director of the National Association of Consumer Advocates, said the bill did not protect the public interest and would have infringed on privacy. Reynolds said consumers would have automatically been opted in to receive phone calls. Their mobile telephone numbers would have been available for purchase, and they would not have been able to choose who accessed their numbers.
So if this bill were enacted, it would mean that without consumers' consent,
any business entity could obtain a consumer's phone number and robocall them on their cell phone.
Reynolds also said consumers would have been up against aggressive robocall software.
These auto-dialing systems are savvy and smart predictive dialers that know when a consumer is likely to answer a phone call. It knows after a consumer has picked up, depending on the length of the pause. This is sophisticated software that dials with intense frequency, 10 calls on the second, 60 calls on the minute.
Putting another black mark on this bill was the question of who would get charged for the phone calls. Reynolds said she was concerned that consumers would have to foot the bill as robocalls used up cell phone minutes and potentially dipped into costly overusage time on calling plans. Nearly 25% of the population uses prepaid wireless plans in which consumers are billed for every call received. Supporters of the bill, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the American Bankers Association, said the current law needs to be modernized. Yet attorneys general in all 50 states oppose the bill. Representative Lee Terry of Nebraska was co-sponsor of the bill. On Wednesday, he declared it dead, done, buried. He said the barrage of criticism the bill produced surprised him. Chalk one up for people-powered lobbying.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 18, 2011, here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today, Noam Chomsky, joining us on the phones for the full hour. Noam Chomsky, I think, needs no introduction. He is a linguist, author, political writer, and it is a great honor to have you join us today, Noam.
Yep, glad to be with you.
And, you know, let's start right off, if we can, with the Iraq War. The troops are coming back to the United States now. The war has been officially declared over. Maybe could we have a quick postmortem? How does the Iraq War now look in history?
Well, it depends who writes history, of course.
Mm-hmm.
History.
How about your version?
History is usually written by the powerful, and we get a very biased version of it. I think what actually happened, and is pretty well recorded by the best, the most sophisticated observers, people like Jonathan Steele, David Gardner, others. What happened is that, first of all, the invasion itself was an act of a major criminal act. I think we should accept the Nuremberg Tribunal judgment that aggression, and this was unquestionably aggression, is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes in that it includes within it all of the evil that follows. So in this case, the invasion includes the horrendous ethnic religious conflict that was stirred up by the war and had horrible effects within Iraq and has by now spread to much of the region. It would include the estimated 4 million people displaced, about 2 million out of the country, including much of the professional classes and anyone who was privileged enough to get out. It includes the unknown numbers, but surely hundreds of thousands of deaths, destruction of a good bit of not only the national heritage, but major treasures of civilization altogether. And of course, there were costs to the United States as well, about 4,000 soldiers, many more seriously injured. Estimates between $1 and $3 trillion of cost. You can pick what you like. The end result, as far as U.S. goals were concerned, is that it was a major defeat. The U.S. did have pretty definite goals. They were made more and more explicit as the scale of the defeat became more evident. At first, as usual, they were hidden, and, you know, first of all, the claims about weapons of mass destruction, then talk about democracy, which, in fact, the U.S. tried to impede every step of the way. And finally, they were just conceded flat out. So if you get to the late days of the Bush administration, fall of 2007, early 2008, there were quite explicit government declarations stating that any outcome, any SOFA, as it's called, Status of Forces Agreement, must include authorization for U.S. combat forces to have bases and continue operations freely, and must include provisions to privilege U.S. investors, meaning in the very lucrative energy system. That was declared an official declaration in November 2007. It was reiterated a couple of months later, January 2008, in one of President Bush's many signing statements, in which he signed congressional legislation but added that he would not implement it insofar as it limited the objectives that I've just mentioned, crucially effective U.S. control over the energy system. Well, the U.S. had to abandon all of this in the face of Iraqi nonviolent resistance as a major triumph of nonviolent resistance. U.S. forces were able to kill militants, but they couldn't deal with hundreds of thousands of protesters in the streets and just the general resistance of the public and its government to U.S. demands. Finally, it was all at least formally abandoned. And if you look at the, we don't know all the details, of course, but it seems pretty likely that the U.S. will have to abandon its military bases, these huge network of military bases that were built all over the country. And the oil contracts that have gone out have not privileged U.S. investors. The government's doing it its own way. Furthermore, the end, if there's a victor in the war, it's generally agreed it's Iran. Its influence over Iraq has expanded. Iraq isn't a client state of Iran. There's plenty of conflict and hostility, but Iranian influence has certainly expanded. The majority Shiite population has, which is the one closest to Iran, though by no means pro-Iranian, has gained a greater, in fact, dominant influence within Iraq. There are great problems remaining. For example, the problems of conflict with over Kirkuk and in general between the Kurdish, relatively autonomous Kurdish regions and the Arab regions, that's completely unresolved. And there are many others, but it was a huge humanitarian, human disaster all around, a major crime. Some of the crimes were really extreme, like the attack on Fallujah. So, for example, if you looked at the press the other day, they mentioned that they did mention the huge celebrations in Fallujah as the American forces pulled out, but didn't really go into the details of what happened there. So, for example, one comment that was quoted was that the people in Fallujah regard it as the Hiroshima of Iraq, but that was not spelled out. Now, they do that for good reasons. The medical studies that have been carried out there have found that effects of radiation from whatever weaponry the U.S. used in its vicious assaults on Fallujah, effects of radiation, they say, are comparable or maybe worse than in Hiroshima. That's the reason for the analogy. And there's a lot more like this. I mean, it's a if history is written accurately, this will really be a major black mark on the aggressors, the United States and Britain.
Noam Chomsky,
I'm going to go to the phone line soon. We already have callers who've called in at 217-333-9455 to ask questions. And the toll-free line is 1-800-222-9455. But before we go to the phone lines, I want to talk about Iran, which you just mentioned. It seems that the news media and the pundit class and many political leaders are already sounding the charge for the United States to go into Iran. And, you know, why is Iran considered such a enemy force by the people who run the United States? And, you know, what's going on there?
Well, actually, we have, fortunately, an authoritative answer to that, though I don't think it's ever been reported. At least I haven't seen it. The Pentagon and U.S. intelligence, joint U.S. intelligence agencies, they give annual reports to Congress on the global security situation. And in the major one in 2010, it did review, of course, the Iranian threat, which is regarded in the international relations literature and in public media as the major threat confronting the United States. And so, of course, they went into it. And what they said is quite illuminating. They said that Iran is not a military threat. Its military spending is, of course, minuscule as compared with the U.S., but it's even low by the standards of the region. They said that the Iranian military doctrine is defensive. It's designed to deter an invasion long enough for diplomacy and negotiations to set in. They discussed the nuclear program and said that if, and they don't know nobody knows whether it's true or not, but if the nuclear program is moving on to what's called nuclear capability, that is, capability to produce a nuclear weapon, which dozens of countries have. If it's moving on to that, they said that would be part of Iran's deterrence strategy. Iran, of course, is under a very severe threat. It's openly threatened with attack by Israel and the United States. That's the meaning of the phrase, all options are open. That means if we want to use nuclear weapons, we'll use them. Of course, that's all in violation of the UN Charter, which bars the threat of force in international affairs. But the U.S. regards itself as essentially a lawless state, which isn't subject to international law. So they are under direct threat. Furthermore, their borders, two of their borders, the countries have been, one still is, occupied by huge forces of the global superpower, which threatening them. It's hard to think of a country in the world that has comparable security problems. So it is quite possible that they are moving to nuclear capability as part of their deterrence strategy, as U.S. Military and intelligence say. The Obama administration is instituting a anti-missile system in Turkey and parts of Europe. The Russians have protested bitterly about this. They understand, as experts on all sides do, that an anti-missile system is basically a first strike weapon. It's strategists on all sides agree to this. Nobody expects it to deter, even if it would work, it wouldn't deter a major first strike, but it conceivably might deter a retaliatory strike after a first strike. So essentially it eliminates the deterrent of a country that might be under attack. So it's essentially a first strike weapon. The U.S. claims that it's directed against Iran. The Russians don't believe that for good reasons. We would never tolerate, say, a Russian military anti-missile system in Canada and Mexico, or a Chinese one, or something like that, because for their reasons. And President Medvedev, a couple of weeks ago, ago announced that Russia would take strong steps to counter this threat, ran through them. They're pretty strong. If the U.S. goes along with this, and that does seriously raise the potential for great power conflict. Now, the claim that it's aimed against Iran is perhaps partly true. That is, it is could be regarded as another first-strike weapon against Iran in the event that Iran ever does develop a deterrent capacity, which would be a small deterrent capacity, an anti-missile system, again, if it ever works, which is a big question, could be a first-strike weapon, eliminating the deterrent for the reasons I mentioned. That's another threat. So Iran, just to recapitulate, Iran, the Iranian government is a very severe threat to its own population. That's not in question. But a threat beyond that, it's interesting to see what it is. It's the threat that it might deter the U.S. and Israeli actions in the region. Now, of course, Iran is also accused of supporting terrorism. That means Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. Whatever you think of those groups, anything you like, what we call their terrorism is what the world pretty much calls resistance. Resistance to U.S.-Israeli aggressive actions. Lebanon has been invaded five times in the last 30 years. Hezbollah is effectively the only deterrent force. In Gaza, again, think what you like about Hamas, but it developed as a force resisting criminal occupation and essentially continues like that. You can love it or hate it, but those are the basic facts. So once again, the threat that is presented officially is essentially deterrence to U.S.-Israeli actions.
Noam Chomsky, one final point on this before we get to the phone lines. The Libya had its uprising this spring, sort of part of the broad revolutions in the region, and the United States and NATO played a large role. And it sort of dredged up again the notion of the United States military being a humanitarian force, sort of a intervention on the sake of democracy and helping people with dictatorial and tyrannical regimes. Do you think, what's your take on that general line of thought, which is so prevalent in U.S. news media and among policymakers?
Here it is, and in England it is. But it's certainly not a global opinion. In fact, the U.S. and the three traditional imperial powers, France, Britain, and the United States, were quite isolated internationally on this. The International Crisis Group, for example, strongly... First of all, we should make it clear that there were two interventions. We have to be clear which one we're talking about. There was an intervention under the auspices of a UN Security Council resolution in 1973, which called for a no-fly zone, a ceasefire, and actions to protect civilians. Well, that intervention lasted about 5 minutes. Then we went to the real intervention, which was it's called a NATO intervention. It means primarily the imperial triumvirate. Immediately intervened on the side of but they became essentially the air force of the rebel armies. Actually, if you look back, Gaddafi offered to accept the UN resolution. Whether that would have worked, we don't know, because it wasn't tried. But the imperial triumvirate immediately just started bombing, not to protect civilians, but to support the rebel army. That's the actual intervention that took place. There were serious efforts by the International Crisis Group, the African Union, it's an African country, of course, the so-called BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and others, to try to to make an effort at diplomacy and negotiations before perhaps deterring the need for violence, but certainly before resorting to violence with its inevitable consequences of humanitarian catastrophes. And they took place. Well, there's a kind of a minor discussion of it this morning in the front page of the New York Times. They did an examination of civilian casualties, point out that NATO refused to examine them. But that's certainly the the tip of an iceberg. There were reports by the Red Cross and independent groups especially from Sirte, the final bombing, which was the bombing of a city which happens to be the base of Libya's largest tribe, and that they report a serious humanitarian catastrophe there, and it's not the only case. That's almost inevitable when you carry out major bombing, thousands of missions, and no matter how closely targeted you think they are. So there were efforts to try to head that off and through diplomacy and negotiations, but the imperial triumvirate wouldn't hear them. It's kind of interesting to hear the African voices. We simply dismiss African voices. But let me read you a couple of things. The African Union issued very strong statements at the beginning calling for diplomacy and negotiations, but also after several months. If I can, I'll read you a couple of the things that haven't been reported here. So they say, whatever the genesis of the intervention by NATO in Libya, the African Union called for dialogue before the UN resolutions that I mentioned and after these resolutions. Ignoring the African Union for 3 months and going on with the bombings of the sacred land of Africa has been high-handed, arrogant, and provocative. An attack on Libya or any other member of the African Union without express agreement by the African Union is a dangerous provocation. Sovereignty has been a tool of emancipation of the peoples of Africa, who are beginning to chart transformational paths for most of the African countries after centuries of predation by the slave trade, colonialism, and neocolonialism. Careless assaults on the sovereignty of African countries are therefore tantamount to inflicting fresh wounds on the destiny of the African peoples. And they go on to warn that this is part of the effort to recolonize Africa, to establish military bases, and so on. Now, African voices are not reported. If they're even mentioned, they're dismissed with the statement that, oh, well, they're all bought off by Gaddafi, which is kind of interesting because it, given the history of the U.S. and Britain in support of Gaddafi right to the end. But there's a little truth to it, and the little truth is worth looking at. Gaddafi, for example, was probably the major funder for the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela's African National Congress. And this was right at the moment when the Reagan administration was supporting the apartheid regime in murderous atrocities in the neighborhood of surrounding countries, over a million killed, but also within South Africa itself. And it was doing it, we may recall, in violation of congressional sanctions and as part of the war on terror that the Reagan administration had declared when it came into office in 1981, something that's forgotten. So in 1988, Washington condemned the African National Congress as, in their words, one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. So we have to therefore defend South African apartheid against Nelson Mandela and his fellow terrorists. That's 1988. Mm-hmm. In fact, Mandela himself was just removed from the terrorist list about 2 years ago. can now come to the United States without special dispensation. Well, during that period, Gaddafi was, in fact, funding the ANC, probably its major funder. And Africans don't forget that. He was a rotten dictator, horrible person, no doubt about it. But that's kind of beside the point. We support worse dictators. And in fact, the U.S. and Britain strongly supported him practically up to the day of the bombing. But anyhow, that's the African reaction. And I think suppressing it is a very serious deficiency, to put it mildly. It's quite racist, in fact. And the African concern over the attack on their very difficult effort to escape the legacy of slavery, colonization, and neocolonialism, that assault is, and the prospect of recolonization, which is not a small threat in one or another form, these are not minor issues.
Our guest today, Noam Chomsky, here on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a few callers waiting patiently. We're going to go to the phone lines immediately. If you'd like to join them with a call for the comment or question for Noam Chomsky, the number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line one now, line four. Let's go to line four, Hawaii. Thank you for your patience. I think you called when the show just began. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Oh, well, hello. It's a real pleasure to have a chance to talk with you two gentlemen, and I much appreciate your respective works. And perhaps a unifying theme of both of your works are calls for greater equity in, you know, the various institutions of our society. And as such, my question is concerning the current state of higher education. And I'm sorry, I'm taking a bit of a turn to the domestic from the international.
That's quite all right.
Right on. Nonetheless, the current state of, say, young people obtaining a humanities degree with economic considerations or perhaps exploits, whatever, but landing themselves $50,000 in debt, or their parents, or $80,000 in debt, what have you. And I guess my question is, does Professor Chomsky consider higher education, undergraduate studies maybe particularly, but in general, does he see that as engendering greater equity in society or lesser? And does he have any observations of some possible reforms to our current system of higher education?
Well, let's take the question of debt, which you mentioned, which is extremely serious. Total debt of college students is huge. I mean, it's a massive sum. And we should recall, as I think you probably hinted, that debt is essentially a disciplinary device. If a student leaves college with a heavy debt, they're trapped. They're going to be compelled to move into a career which will help them escape the debt. So, for example, you know, maybe some kid goes to law school because he wants to be a public interest lawyer, from which you make essentially nothing. But if he comes out of law school with a huge debt, he's more or less compelled, he or she is more or less compelled to go into corporate law. And once you get caught up in that system, you easily get absorbed into it. You begin to pick up the values, and you're essentially trapped. And it's the same in other cases. Now, if we look back, there are two questions that ought to be asked about the debt. First, is it economically necessary? Second, how did it come about? Well, is it economically necessary? Let's take a look at our neighbor, Mexico, a poor country. They have quite a good higher education college and higher education system. UNAM, the major university, is pretty high quality. I've visited, I've lectured there, know a fair amount about it. Reasonable facilities, very high level. Serious students, terrible salaries, of course, but by any reasonable standards, it's quite a good university. Furthermore, in Mexico, city itself, there's a university which is, I should add, I say this, that UNAM's higher education is free. There was an effort about 10 years ago to raise, to institute small tuitions. That led to a national student strike, and the government backed down. In fact, students 10 years later are still occupying an administration building on the UNAM campus, which is used as a kind of a movement center. The police didn't come in, and so on. In Mexico City, the city itself, there is a city university, which is not only free, but has open admissions with supportive efforts for students who haven't had the right background. Well, I've been there too, and you know, don't claim to be an expert on it, but it, my impression is it's quite successful and high level. Now, this is a poor country, not a rich country like ours. If we go to another rich country, say Germany, they also have free higher education, virtually free. We can go on, but I don't think it's an economic problem. I think it's a question of choice as to how to use resources. And in the United States, they are used to discipline students and to privilege the kinds of students who can pay these colossal costs, I mean, rich families, basically. Well, that's question one. Question two, where does it come from? Well, I've never really seen a careful study of this, so this is somewhat speculative. But my impression is that it grew out of the, I think it largely took off in the early 70s, and I think it grew out of the deep concern expressed by elites across the spectrum, right to what's called left, over the activism and of the 60s and the independence shown by students. They're breaking out of conformity, and more generally, the shift of large parts of the population to into the public arena. People who were expected to be passive and acquiescent began to press their interests and concerns in the public arena. And that led to what was called a crisis of democracy. I'm now quoting views at the what's called the liberal extreme, the Trilateral Commission, essentially the Carter administration, essentially withdrew almost entirely from their ranks. They were concerned. They published an important book called The Crisis of Democracy, in which they said that democracy is being threatened by the fact that there's too much democracy. In the 60s, they said normally passive and acquiescent parts of the population began to be concerned about their own rights and entered the political arena. Women, farmers, young people, old people, students, you know, working people, in fact, the general population. And that created an overload on the state, they said. And therefore, we have to have more moderation in democracy. They have to go back to following orders. And they were particularly concerned with what they called, this is their term, not mine, what they called the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. They said they're not doing their job. That's colleges, universities, schools, churches. They're not indoctrinating the young properly, and something has to be done about it. That's the kind of liberal extreme. Go over to the right wing, and you have things like the very important Powell Memorandum, the memorandum written by the man who later was appointed by Nixon to be Justice Powell. He was at the time a lobbyist, corporate lobbyist, I think, for tobacco companies. And he sent around a memorandum around 1971. It was addressed to the American Chamber of Commerce, the main business lobby. And it's worth reading. You can pick it up on the Internet. Basically, he said that the colleges and universities are getting out of control. They're becoming critical of business, critical of capitalist ideology. It's his version of the institutions for the indoctrination of the young aren't doing their job. He said, look, he said to the business world, he said, we have the resources. We're just not using them. We should use our resources to ensure that the colleges and universities go back to discipline and subordination to acceptable ideology and so on. Well, those are the two extremes within the political system. And approximately at that time, there were changes in how universities function. For example, tuition started going up. Even university architecture changed. Incidentally, this is global, not just in the United States. But new university architecture, quite typically, it's been discussed in the architectural literature, was designed to avoid open places where students can meet, things like, say, Sproul Plaza in Berkeley. So they can go from one place to another, but no place where they'd gather, meaning have a get-together or have demonstrations, interactions, and so on. Well, all of these changes began at that time. It's part of very general changes in American society. The economy at the same time began to shift radically from production for use, you know, manufacturing of things people need, to financialization, playing games with money, and offshoring of production. Those were major developments in the 70s, have had a huge effect on the whole society up till today. But I think what happened to the colleges and universities is part of this. There's also, as you indicated, a corresponding shift towards trying to direct students to commercially viable activities, you know, things they'll make money from. It varies as to how it's done. I don't want to exaggerate, but the tendency is pretty clear. There's also changes in the research agenda. So there's more. Take my own university, MIT, major research university. During the 50s and the 60s, the great growth period of modern American history, in fact, American history altogether, during that period, the university was mainly government-funded, actually, incidentally, by the Pentagon, overwhelmingly. And it was very free research. That's why you have things like computers, the Internet, the IT revolution, and so on. It was developed in those years, partly at MIT, partly elsewhere, substantially through government initiative and funding and procurement and so on. Over the years, that's changed. So by now, first of all, funding, government funding has shifted from the Pentagon to the health-related institutions and National Institute of Health and so on. There's good reason for that. The cutting edge of the economy has shifted. During the 50s and the 60s, it was electronics-based, and the Pentagon was a good cover for developing the high-tech electronics-based economy. Over the years, it's shifting towards being biology-based. So the NIH and other similar government institutions are a good cover for funding that next stage of the high-tech, of the advanced economy. But also it's shifted towards commercial funding by private businesses. And that has a number of effects. One effect is it tends to direct research and development activities towards more short-term objectives, not long-term. Computers, for example, were serious research on them, began in the early 1950s. It was almost 30 years before they became marketable and were handed over to private companies for profit. Private enterprise isn't really interested in that. They want short-term results. The other effect that's noticeable is a shift towards secrecy. Now, a contract can't require secrecy, but there are ways around that. It can be made clear that if you want the grant renewed, you're going to have to keep it secret because it's the company itself that wants the profits, not the economy generally. And that's noticeable. In some cases, it even led to scandals that reached the front page of the Wall Street Journal. But these tendencies are there. Along with them has been the sharp growth of tuition, which I think should be regarded primarily as a disciplinary technique. It's a way to ensure that the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young do their job better. Now, there's plenty of resistance to this. I don't want to suggest that this is a description of the way higher education works. The tendencies are there. The effects are there. There's resistance to it, and I think it's something that requires serious thought. Incidentally, the same is true K through 12, you know, schools. So things like No Child Left Behind, Obama's Race to the Top, and so on, I think these are largely disciplinary programs. Teaching to test is not a way to educate people if you're interested in fostering children's abilities to carry out free, creative, independent work cooperatively with others, which is what education ought to be. But you don't have that when you're teaching for test, and when teachers' salaries depend on how well students do in tests and not how well they do in being educated. I think all of that has a pernicious effect on the elementary education system.
Noam Chomsky, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're rounding into the final lap of the program today, and we've got a couple of callers I want to get to. But Noam, to follow up on this point briefly, if we can, the Occupy movement, which has been overwhelmingly a movement of young people, has burst onto the scene in the past 3 months across the United States on the heels of the mass protest in Wisconsin and Ohio and other states earlier in 2011. And you were there and involved in the great uprisings of the 1960s and early 1970s, and we sort of had a long interregnum with not much action. How do you view the Occupy movement from your experience?
Well, just a qualification. I don't think it's quite true that there was no reaction. So, for example, there were very substantial solidarity movements in the 1980s, solidarity with Central Americans who were being devastated by U.S.-run terrorist attacks. In fact, that's the first time in history that tens of thousands of people from the aggressor society, the United States, tens of thousands of citizens went down to help the victims. That never happened before. You know, nobody went to live in a Vietnamese village to try to help and in the hope that a white face might fend off state terrorists. French citizens didn't go to Algeria to live with the victims. I mean, this is really something new and dramatic.
Okay, no, that's fair enough.
And there have been other cases, but you're basically right. I mean, we have been through an absolutely unprecedented period for 30 years. I mean, you go back to the origins of U.S. history. It hasn't been done in pretty ways, to put it mildly. But the fact of the matter is it has been a developing, growing society, industrializing, growing, economy, getting richer, and so on. There have been ups and downs, but that's been the general trajectory. And in fact, even in the worst periods, there was often a sense of hopefulness. I mean, I'm just old enough to remember the Depression. And in the latter 1930s, after the first shock, it was objectively much worse than it is now, but subjectively, it was quite different. Most of my family was unemployed, working class, but there was a sense that we're going to get out of this. The things we can do together, there's CIO organizing, there's the WPA programs, there's worker education. We'll find a way out of it somehow. That's not the feeling today, by any means. There's fear, there's anger, there's disillusionment, there's a sense that the country is in deep trouble. It's an elite feeling, too. So, for example, take a look at the current issue of the main establishment international relations journal, Foreign Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations. A big headline on the front cover, "Is America Over?" well, you know, kind of apocalyptic, but it does express the feeling. Now, for the general population, during this period, this essentially neoliberal period, there has been plenty of wealth created, and it's gone into very few pockets. Everyone knows that inequality has soared. Not everyone is aware that it's not 1%, as the Occupy movement says. It's more like 0.1%, which has an overwhelming impact on the inequality. That means it's mostly from the financial sector, which is not, it's dubious that it contributes to the economy, may overall harm it, but it's huge. So by 2007, before the crash, it was about 40% of corporate profits. Go back to the 1960s, it was a tiny fraction of that. So the effect has been to highly concentrate wealth. For the general population over a generation, it's been a period of stagnation, pretty much stagnation in wealth, stagnation, even decline. People have been getting by, but by increasing work hours well beyond Europe, debt, which can't go on forever, and bubbles, financial bubbles, asset bubbles of one kind or another, which, of course, crash. In the 50s and the 60s, there weren't any. Reason is the New Deal regulations were in effect, and banks were acting like banks, not like speculators. But that's changed since the early Reagan years. Regular bubbles, continual bailouts of financial institutions over and over, each crash worse than the last one. For the general population, it's been a big change from the whole of American history. The country's deindustrializing. Industrialization, manufacturing continues, but overseas. So corporations in the United States are making plenty of money by manufacturing. So Apple, for example, is making plenty of money, but the production is being done in East Asia. There's a dynamic East Asian production system. China's more or less the assembly plant. Workers in Foxconn, say, put together Apple and Dell computers, work under hideous conditions, ridiculously low pay, awful conditions, constantly constant uprising, suicides, and so on. The parts and the components, the sophisticated technology, is mostly coming from the surrounding countries, Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, and from the West, too, from the United States. And they're assembled there and, you know, sent back here, very little value added in China. But there's plenty of profits here, but no jobs. That generalizes. Well, at the same time, the cost of elections has skyrocketed. That drives the political parties deeper into corporate profits, the pockets. And Republicans is kind of reflexive. They have almost ceased to be a political party in any traditional sense. And the Democrats, who are mostly what used to be called moderate Republicans, are not all that far behind. Well, this picture has led to severe disillusionment, fright, anger, contempt for institutions, all sorts of reactions that are a kind of a dangerous mix. Okay, now to the Occupy movement. That's the first really significant organized popular attempt to confront all of this. I think it's extremely important. They've had quite a significant impact already. Inevitably, they're facing repression, just as the popular movements in North Africa and Middle East are. Big question, which is going to be of historic importance, I think, is how they react to it. Can these incipient movements find a way to move into larger constituencies, help organize them, turn anger, frustration, hatred, and fear into some constructive force that'll respond to the developments that have been taking place? That's a major question. Not easy, but I think it can be done.
Let's go to probably the caller's way, the longest in line in the history of Media Matters in the last 10 years. Let's go to line one, Savoy. You're on the air with Noam Chomsky.
Thank you, gentlemen. Real quickly, I'd like to ask about your views on the Stop Online Piracy Act, and where, you know, people could, you know, the government could shut down entire websites if it is alleged to be containing pirated material. I'll hang up and listen. Thank
you very much, caller. Noam Chomsky, are you familiar with this?
Sort of, but mainly from your work, so you can answer it a lot better than I can.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot online about it that says it pretty well. I wouldn't have much to add to the Stop Online Piracy Act. It's before Congress right now, and I think it's being stalled largely because there are powerful corporate interests like Google and Facebook that oppose it strongly. If they didn't, it would pass without any comment. But Noam Chomsky, I think that does lead to an important question, which is, you know, you've been doing media criticism. You did your seminal work alone and with Ed Herman in the 1980s, Manufacturing Consent, Necessary Illusions, probably most prominently. Has the internet changed journalism in a way that you'd have to rethink your basic view of the U.S. news media as a propaganda system?
Not really. I mean, it's changed things, undoubtedly. It's had both positive and negative effects. I think the positive ones outweigh the negative ones, but they're all there. The internet means that you can, if you want, get to sources of information, discussion, opinion that is unlikely to be found in the major media. So take, say, the Middle East again. There is a direct reporting, high-quality direct hour-by-hour reporting in the Middle East from Al Jazeera. Well, you can't pick it up on television. I think there's maybe two towns which have cable access, maybe more by now. But you can pick it up on the Internet. You can pick up Democracy Now! On the Internet. There are many very good commentators, very astute commentators, people like, say, Dean Baker on the economy, or Glenn Greenwald, mostly on civil liberties issues, who are there regularly, and you can pick them up and read commentary that you're not going to find in the, you'll very rarely find in the press.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on and on. I don't even want to mention things because I'll leave things out and it won't be fair. But there's quite a lot of that. On the other hand, you have to know what you're looking for. For most of the population, that doesn't mean anything. You have to have an organized, educated population to know even what to look for. And so, I don't know the numbers, but it's a very small part of the population that can even investigate these things. Like what I just quoted from the African Union, that's on the Internet. So if you know where to look, I happen to be quoting from a journal from India. If you know to look for a journal from India, you can find it. That's a special privilege for people who have the, you know, the training, the background, the resources, even the time to do things like this. Part of the downside of the Internet is that it can become a, I don't want to put it too harshly, but a kind of a cult generator.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good thing about the Internet is you can put up anything that comes to mind. And a lot of the things that come to mind are sensible and worth pursuing, but a lot of them are really highly misleading at best.
Noam Chomsky, unfortunately at that point, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Noam, for taking time out of your day and your life to join us here at Media Matters, and let's try to make this a more regular event.
Hope so. Yeah.
Great. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for engineering the board today. I want to thank my wonderful producer, Christina Williams, for her great work today. I want to apologize to Line 2 in Champaign County. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone have a great holiday next week. We won't be back until January 1st. Have a wonderful holiday season. See you then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.